From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Cliff Roski is a legal scholar. Lisa Diamond is an acclaimed researcher in human sexuality. And it seems like the paper they're writing together is a risk. What they're saying is that the time has finally come to retire this argument used by human rights advocates that you're born that way, born gay or bisexual or straight. Because according to the science, you're not born that way. Or anyway, it's more complicated than that. This is risky because the idea that people choose to be gay is the argument opponents of same-sex marriage and gay rights have used for decades. Today in the program, Roski and Diamond are joining us to explain why they say it's time to ditch the born-that-way argument. And this is more than about just science. They argue you don't need it in legal cases anymore, and they say it's unfair to those who don't fit into a category. A new twist on Nature versus Nurture, after the news. This week on Video West, a beautiful, sad story of a Mormon missionary who did what you're not supposed to do when you're out there. He fell in love. And he had to make that impossible choice, his faith or his heart. It's called Elder. In our favorite section this week, see a lovely piece produced by Jonathan Goldstein at the CBC. Goldstein is ending his great radio program, Wiretap. And in this short, you hear advice on what it means to age gracefully. Go watch at videowest@kuer.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So for decades now, the immutability of sexual orientation, this idea that there's a biological explanation for why people are gay or bisexual or transgendered, that's been a crucial argument in the legal and political debate over LGBT rights. And you can see why when you look at some of the arguments made by opponents of same-sex marriage, for example. They say people are just making a choice. This is a lifestyle choice, not a scientific reality. So saying you were born this way has provided a lot of comfort for people in the LGBT community over the years. But Cliff Roski and Lisa Diamond say the time has come to get rid of the born this way argument. Roski's a legal scholar, Diamond a researcher in human sexuality, and in a paper they're writing together, they say, if there ever was a moment when it was possible and most important to retire this argument, that moment has arrived. And today in the program, they're joining us to explain why. First of all, they say it's not accurate scientifically, and we'll get into that. But also, they say you don't need it in legal cases anymore. And not only that, they say these arguments are just unfair. Unjust is how they put it. For those whose sexuality isn't fixed, because it turns out human sexuality is pretty fluid. Clifford Roski is a law professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He's a past board chair of Equality Utah. And Professor, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lisa Diamond, a professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah. Welcome back to you, Professor Diamond.
Thank you.
We also have with us Jim Taberry, who's a philosophy professor at the University of Utah, author of the book Beyond Verses, The Struggle to Understand the Interaction of Nature and Nurture. He's going to give us some philosophical perspective as we go along. Professor, welcome to you. Thanks for being with
Good
us.
Good to be here.
Well, I wanted to begin, let's begin broadly. So in essence, what you're saying, and this is as we'll break down the sort of scientific and the legal cases as we go, but what you're saying is that it's time to ditch this argument. It doesn't really work that way. It's not really accurate. And it's time to move on. Are you guys sure it's time to move on? Well, it seems like I have like 10 different versions of this question. Like, are you sure you're ready to move on?
And I also think it's necessary to point out that there's a difference between sort of the U.S. context and the international context.
Yep.
And there are still, you know, I think Uganda is a perfect example of a place where, you know, they're not even willing to say that it's just – you know, okay for, you know, lesbian and gay bisexual individuals to exist. They're passing very stringent laws prohibiting that form of sexuality. So I think it's important to clarify that we're focusing on the United States context, and that probably also has relevance for other, you know, industrialized Western, you know, nations that are more progressive. But internationally, the picture might look somewhat different. So I do think that's an important thing to clarify.
What about you? And from a strategic point of view, hasn't the idea that people are born a certain way, hasn't that been incredibly helpful in the struggle for human rights?
And I don't think either of us would deny that the argument has been helpful in advancing the cause of gay rights for many years. But the question that we pose now is, what next? What now? And I do think as Professor Diamond says, in the U.S. context. I actually think that the country is moving on already. I've seen this in my students just in the last 5 to 10 years. When I started teaching, all of my students intuitively understood that everything was at stake in the nature-nurture debate. If it was nature, it was okay. If it was nurture, cases were sunk. And now when this subject comes up in my classrooms, they look at me like, why are you asking me this question? Mm-hmm. There's an offensive implication to the question itself. And it's really uniform. And it's not like I'm teaching in San Francisco, right? This isn't Salt Lake City.
So you think this is a generational thing? Something that you've come to eventually over time is something that maybe this millennial generation or this younger generation just sort of understands based on their life. It's just counterintuitive to them almost.
And also probably their own experiences. I think Professor Diamond would confirm that more and more youth are not identifying as simply gay or lesbian or fixed, but in sort of a more flexible or fluid way.
I also think that something that has also changed is that among the younger generation, they're also skeptical of a born that way argument that makes them feel like they're diseased, right? So a lot of, you know, whereas there was, I think, a generation of LGBT individuals who did feel comforted by that argument, like, I was born this way. It's like, it's natural. It's just a part of who I am. There has always been a segment of the LGBT population that says, well, that makes it sound like a disorder that I was born with. Like, oh, I was born with this cleft palate. And they've always been skeptical of that as well. So I think that sort of downside of the born that way argument is also something that I think a younger generation of LGBT individuals really realizes and recognizes and pushes against.
It seems something I think you see in religious cultures in Utah, in particular, this idea that homosexuality is an affliction you just have to get over,
suffer through.
Yeah,
you know, like, oh, we should feel sorry for this population. Like, let's let them get married, these poor devils. And I think that there's skepticism of that approach now.
This is something that you had talked about, Professor Roski. You and I said this off the air, actually, in a previous program. There's this statement by Justice Anthony Kennedy in the landmark decision that came down. And you saw it all over Facebook and people saying how lovely it was and how beautiful it was. And I have to say, it didn't really warm your cockles as much as kind of annoy you. And I wanted to read part of it because it seems to get at the bigger point that you're getting at with this. And he says, and a lot of people will remember it, that the petitioners in these cases who want same-sex marriage do respect marriage. They respect it so deeply. They're seeking to find its fulfillment for themselves. And he says their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. You hate that.
I do. I don't regard people who choose not to marry as condemned to a life of loneliness. There were some of the Supreme Court justices who signed that opinion would, I suppose, be in this framework condemned to a life of loneliness, right? And indeed, we're all born lonely in that sense. It's just a bit much
There's
for me.
There's plenty of people who are lonely in their marriage.
Indeed. So, and I guess the broader point is winning is very important. And there are certainly contexts, like in Uganda, where winning is everything. If someone says, if you can't say that you're born that way, then you'll be executed. Yeah. Well, then you say you were born that way. I mean, right? This is, some things matter more than others. But it's important to win for the right reasons. And that was not a good example of that. And another statement from that opinion that Professor Diamond and I are very concerned about is this statement that recently, psychiatrists have discovered that sexual orientation is not just normal, homosexuality is not just normal, but immutable, and that the reason that same-sex marriage is a right is that gays have no other choice. They have to marry someone of the same sex. And that's just not the reason that this is a freedom that all Americans enjoy.
Because what you're saying is, so what?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That does not matter. That shouldn't come into the equation. And in fact, the case you make, as we'll get to this in the legal argument, is it hasn't really come into the case that much, which surprised me, I have to say, that immutability was less a factor in legal cases than I thought.
Indeed, for the same reason that it doesn't matter whether I was born heterosexual,
yeah,
whether I have the freedom to marry a woman or not. That's completely irrelevant.
And I think Cliff and I were both, as we embarked on this paper, I think we were both surprised a bit by how much it had. And I remember getting an email from you at one point, and you were like, you know, I've now reviewed like every single, you know, and I've never actually looked at every single one looking for that particular argument. And wow, it really hasn't played a big role. And then when the decision came down, most recently, you know, you see one sentence about immutability that is sort of a throw-off line, like, oh, well, everybody knows that it's immutable. But then that was not the basis of the decision. So it was an interesting kind of moment reading that and seeing that clearly the vestiges of that argument are still around, but it's actually not from a legal perspective, it's not the basis on which we are winning some of the biggest victories that we've ever won.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to a little bit more of that because I want to dig into these particular points. Jim Tabor, let me bring you in this point. In the paper, Professor Roskey and Professor Diamond, they mentioned that our society has this fascination over genetic origin stories to help us understand all kinds of human behavior and human characteristics. Why is that? Why are we intrigued by this idea of there being some biological explanation for why we behave the way we behave, do you think?
I think because when you're talking about genetic origins, you're potentially talking about a number of different things. So in this context of conversations about the nature and nurture of sexuality and gender, there's a number of different questions that you actually might be thinking about when you're in this domain. So on the one hand, this is a bit what we've been talking about. You might be interested in the choice question. Is this something that's chosen or not? On the other hand, you might be interested in sort of, you know, is it genes or environment? There's also a kind of historically, it's the disorder question. Is this a disorder or is it a healthy, normal behavior? And then finally, there's also there's a morality question. Is homosexual behavior immoral or not? And talking about these origins sort of mashes all those together. And historically, there were dichotomized answers to each of those. So in early and in mid-20th century psychiatry, psychoanalysis, you know, ruled. And the thought was homosexuality is a disorder. It's a product of poor parenting, over-mothering and under-fathering. It's a choice. You can get treated. And it's nurture. So those things all went together. As the scientific medical community and I think culture more generally started thinking, well, this isn't necessarily a disorder. Maybe it isn't necessarily immoral. I think the opposite answers to the choice question and the nature-nurture question just kind of came along for the ride. The thought was, well, if the other side is saying it's a choice, then it not being a choice. And if the other side is saying it's nurture, then it looks like nature is kind of what our option is. And so you have these four questions all getting sort of muddled together, and it looks like if you're on this side, the whole thing's a package. So one of the things that's nice about Professor Diamond and Roskey's paper is it's a sort of attempt to disentangle the choice aspect from something like the morality and legal aspect.
We'll talk a little bit more, too, about one of the focuses of the book that you've written is that it's time to ditch the nature versus nurture argument anyway, that we sort of moved beyond that and we've got to find a way, if I understand it right, to live with the interaction between those, because that's the way it works.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I have to say, though, Professor Diamond, this question of whether or not it's a choice, all those things that you were mentioning, the argument in the past, is it a choice?
For some people, it can be.
Right. And that's the thing.
That's like the big taboo that like nobody wants to talk about.
Exactly.
And we mentioned in the paper a quote by Cynthia Nixon, the well-known actress from Sex and the City fame, who was, you know, making like just a garden variety, like gay rights speech, you know, somewhere. And she said, you know, I've been, because she had lived for many years, you know, having relationships with men before she ended up with a woman relatively later in her love career.
Yeah.
And she said, I've been straight and I've been gay and gay is better. And the gay community just went just wild with, oh my God, you can't say that because it makes it seem like it's a choice. And so then she responded in an interview in the New York Times, well, for me, it is a choice. And no one else gets to define what my experience is. I sort of experience my sexuality as if it was a choice. And that was so controversial that she ended up retracting that statement and saying, I didn't really mean that I chose it. And that, I think, is really emblematic of the problem with this perspective, that we end up saying there are certain types of experiences that are valid, that are worth respect and dignity, and that are consistent with a progressive approach. And if your experience doesn't fit that, then you cannot speak. And it's amazing that the gay community is silencing its own members, and, you know, for the sake of the benefit of the rights of the community as a whole. But part of the argument that we're making is that we cannot base a civil rights strategy that basically draws a line around certain experiences that are deserving of protection and deserving of respect, and then take people like Cynthia Nixon or the many other people whose experiences are different from that and saying, you better shut up, and you don't really deserve the same sort of protections as the individuals who say that they knew from age 8 that they were gay.
10% of gay men, 30% of lesbians, 60% of bisexual men and women, you say in the paper, reported that they had some degree of choice in their sexual orientation.
Yeah. And there are far larger percentages that report some degree, and from, and these are figures from representative, huge national studies that have tracked individuals over time, report some degree of change in their pattern of sexual attraction. Every large sample representative random study that's been done, both in the United States and elsewhere, has found that somewhere between 30 and 60% of individuals with same-sex attractions report some change in their pattern of attraction over periods of time ranging between 5 and 15 years. So fluidity is not just a niche phenomenon. Yeah. It's a normal part of the sexual minority life course. And so if we develop a legal strategy that says everyone is fixed, it's just wrong. Yeah. And the other side already knows that. The briefs that have been filed in a lot of these cases show that folks who want to oppose LGBT rights are aware of the scientific data on change, and they use it against arguments for rights. They say, well, you know, if there's this change, then this isn't even a clear population. It doesn't even exist. It's just this morass. So it's up to advocates for LGBT rights to be responsible in our presentation of the scientific data so that we don't leave ourselves open to those sorts of completely, you know, asinine critiques.
Do we know why they change and what role culture and external influences play in it? Because you say in the paper, social influence in the form of increased visibility and acceptance of same-sex sexuality likely plays a role in this longitudinal change. Mm-hmm. So is it accurate to say that increased social acceptance of same-sex sexuality is, on some level, creating more people who call themselves self-identified?
I know, it's like, I saw your pause. You're like, is it promoting the spread of homosexuality?
Well, this is what you hear from religious conservatives, exactly. That in fact, permissive societies create gay people.
And as
so
Professor Roski, you know, reviewed, you know, studies and cases in which that is brought up as an argument against LGBT rights. If we're more accepting, then more folks will decide that this is an okay thing. And in fact, it does appear that there are large-scale historical trends. If you look at some of the national studies that have been done in the United States and in Britain, yeah, where the same exact survey is done every 10 years or so, you are seeing historical increases in the number of individuals reporting same-sex attractions and same-sex behavior. Are we creating more homosexuals?
Right,
probably not. What probably doesn't change is the capacity for same-sex attraction, and given that the majority of individuals with same-sex attractions have bisexual patterns of attraction, that's probably what we're seeing, that individuals who have the capacity for both probably ignore the same-sex part of their desires, but now they have
Now you also say that this has been happening for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is not a new
thing. Phenomenon. It's just
like Will and Grace didn't create all this, right?
I don't think Will and Grace,
permissive societies that
But with regard to the causes of change, the one thing that we can definitively say does not appear to change patterns of sexual desire is reparative therapy.
Yeah, that's a big one we have to talk
that
about.
That effortful change, there really is no evidence that that is effective. So the change that we're seeing appears to happen on its own. It's sort of naturally occurring change. Effortful change doesn't appear to work very well, and I think that's an important distinction to make.
So, because I would expect that people who, religious people who are trying to in some way alter their orientation. And those are the people who are drawn to these reparative therapies.
Yeah.
They want to fix themselves, I think is how they put it. It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. It appears a lot more – what I often tell my students is it appears much easier to create same-sex attractions than to get rid of them once you have them. It's like unringing a bell. So I think it's easier to discover that capacity over time and have that be a socially influenced process. But once you're aware of those attractions, it appears that eliminating attractions doesn't appear to be possible.
Jim Tibbery, let me ask you your observation of this part of the conversation, mm-hmm. the scientific idea that it's all right now we're talking about, in fact, some of these taboos are going to be out there. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the way the conversation is going to play out now? Because you're going to get a lot of sort of I told you so's on one side and you're going to have to be very careful. It seems like Lisa Diamond, because they're already using your research against the argument for same-sex rights and marriage and those kinds of things. So how do you see this argument playing out? Now, let's say we shift gears here. How do you see the argument playing out now? What do you make of it at this point?
Well, so this is a great place to disentangle the moral question about homosexuality from the nature-nurture question. So the exchange that you and Lisa were just having was about – you know, to what extent can the environment and changes in the environment in which we live, you know, facilitate people being more comfortable engaging in homosexuality? That's only a problem if you think there's something wrong with homosexuality.
Right. Right.
You know, if you take that question off the table, then you're just sort of, you know, you might be interested in what's going to increase or decrease, you know, people playing violins, or what's going to increase or decrease, you know, you can think of any traits. What gets this one, you know, particularly complicated is there's this whole moral component involved in a way that people aren't, you know, doing awful things to people who play violins.
I mean, that's a great. There's a great quote from Judge Walker. Cliff, you can that the state of California has no interest in reducing
the number of gays and lesbians in the state of California. Yeah, that is, you know, the question was posed, well, if we legalize same-sex marriage in California, then children might learn about it in school and they might, you know, then be more likely to enter same-sex marriages and then perhaps more people would come to California. All these are, and the judge simply said, well he shifted the question, right? So that's, I think, what we're talking about here.
Opponents, to say what? That's your thing and it's not my concern?
That is, opponents have said, why are you gay? What's making you gay? And he and we are saying, well, why do you care? Why does that matter? How about you get out of my bedroom, my family, my childhood, my genes, and just mind your business? Because it doesn't matter how many gays and lesbians there are in the state of California or Utah or anywhere else.
Cliff Roski is – Clifford Roski. Can I call you Clifford? I'm never sure which. Clifford Roski, a law professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. Lisa Diamond, a professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah. She's the author of the book Sexual Fluidity. And we have Jim Tabery with us, a philosophy professor at the University of Utah. He's author of the book Beyond Verses. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Going to oversimplify this a bit, but here's the question for this program today. Are you born gay? Are you born bisexual? Are you born straight? That is to say, do you come into the world with your sexual orientation already determined by your biology? And this has been a crucial question in the debate over same-sex marriage and equal rights for LGBT people. But our guests today, the legal scholar Clifford Roski and the psychologist Lisa Diamond, say, first, it's no longer scientifically accurate to say that you are, in fact, born that way. But secondly, and this is the most important part, legally it shouldn't matter. A right is a right. So, Lisa Diamond, before we leave the scientific argument, the idea of consensus and the genetic component here, Are we coming to a consensus yet? It seems we're still up in the air a little bit on the question of whether or not there's a gay gene.
It's getting more complicated, partly because our understanding of genetics is more complicated. For example, some of the newest research is actually on epigenetics rather than genetics, and that's about the way in which certain environmental experiences, and the environment can include the womb as well as, you know, the first months of life, can actually change the expression of certain genes in ways that actually can be passed down and actually change the genome. So our understanding of genetics itself is becoming a lot more complicated and sophisticated, and that is a part of the difficulty. But what we do know is that there does appear to be a genetic contribution to sexual orientation, but that contribution is not deterministic, and it explains maybe about 30% of the population variability.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's about the same as the amount of population variability in job satisfaction that can be explained by genetics. And yet you don't see any magazine covers saying, is this child born satisfied with their job? Right? So we tend to emphasize genes for something like sexual orientation, and we don't focus so much on the fact that smoking is heritable, that a lot of other important traits are heritable. So, like a lot of things, it's definitely genetically influenced, but that does not provide the last word on how you get a gay or lesbian or bisexual person. It's also – the other thing that scientists have reached consensus on is that there appear to be multiple pathways and that different individuals can have mixes of different pathways. So there is no single cause, and that's why it's another good reason to get away from causation because there is no one cause.
But don't you worry mothers are going to start freaking out again? That they're causing their kids to be gay because they were too
– Well, actually, we do – the one causal pathway that we've pretty much ruled out is parental influence. Mm-hmm. And there have been twin
this
studies.
Is a big thing. Also fathers that
I know.
Distant. And, you know,
that has been pretty rigorously studied in a lot of twin studies. And they basically found that the one amount of influence that is 0% is shared family, right? So – what mom and dad are doing appears to be the least important thing to make an individual gay or not.
Lisa is with us in Salt Lake City. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm really enjoying the program, and I really appreciate your taking the subject. But I did want to make a point that transgendered individuals do not appear to be in this area of choice or fluidity. At least primary transgendered individuals, one of whom I'm married to, do seem to be born with a different gender identity from their physical identity.
Lisa, I'm clear that up for us. How do we understand it in that context?
Yeah, I appreciate the question, and it's an important one. As with sexual orientation, one of the things we're finding is that there are different subtypes of transgender individuals. Some of them do appear to experience their gender identity as something that they were born with at a very early age. And there's actually some really fascinating neurobiological research showing that there are actually pretty important structural brain differences between male to female transsexuals and men who were born men that suggest that a potential, you know, very early origin having to do with prenatal exposure to androgens. However, there are many transgender individuals who don't have that experience and who say, for me, it's very fluid. I only became aware of it, you know, late in life. So individuals like the caller's partner might experience it as something they were born with. And then there are transgender individuals who don't. So similar to the case with sexual orientation, we want to develop a framework for transgender rights and respect that doesn't privilege individuals who experience it as fixed and early appearing over the experiences of those who have a more complicated developmental trajectory.
Thanks for the call. Rachel with us in Salt Lake City. Rachel, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question, I guess, about the moral aspect of this whole question, which is another interesting thing to bring up in the state of Utah. If one group of people, like you were saying, definitely thinks that it's okay, sexual fluidity, and another group of people, as far as the moral question, doesn't think it's okay, how is that going to play out in society?
Cliff Ruske, will you take that one? Because I think this is the question. You know, we had you on the program to talk about what would be the next step for LGBT rights, you know, now that this landmark case has come down. But as you know, opponents of same-sex marriage are also looking for their platform. Religious liberty is one of those things. So what are you anticipating?
Well, I think the answer is context specific. If there's one group that thinks it's okay and sort of doesn't need to know what the origins are beyond the scientific question, right, that it's legally or morally irrelevant, and then there's another group that doesn't think it's okay and thinks that it matters not only morally but even legally and could justify discrimination, then it matters which group's in power very much, right? and so in Uganda, you know, yeah. This could easily dictate the kind of arguments that you're free to make. But I think that we're at a point now with four landmark Supreme Court victories for the gay rights movement that the legal and moral necessity for this argument is outdated. And it's sort of safe to move on. It's an interesting question whether the transgender...
Hold on. Can I push back on the question, on the idea of whether it's safe to move on?
Yeah.
You may be right, but I wonder have you... And Jim Tabor, I want to get you on this part too. Have you considered the street in the sense that you have bullying going on, schoolyards, these kinds of questions? They're not going to take into account this bigger, broader, legal, sociological, scientific context. If they just figure that you chose this way, you're going to get the hell beaten out of you. And I wonder if that is something that you've taken into account.
Well, I actually think that the kids were getting the hell beaten out of them. I don't think the kids who were beating them up really care whether they chose it or not.
They were just different.
Didn't
matter
how they got that way. Yeah, exactly. And so I think the best way to push back on that is exactly what's been happening, you know, in this country for the past 20 years. Growing acceptance, growing exposure. Kids now, my own niece and nephew have, you know, friends whose parents are gay, and so they it's becoming a more common thing, and the visibility of it. And I think that's what ends up changing those sorts of attitudes is simple exposure. And I don't think that kids bullying other kids are reading Supreme Court decisions.
And I also don't think that they were born bullying other kids, mm-hmm. that they were taught that these kids chose that. It was a bad choice. They're different and they're wrong because they're different. And so it matters a great deal sort of how we re-educate the country's youth.
Jim Tapir, what do you think about all of that?
Yeah, I think I'll probably say what you just said, you know, another way. It's we're not tolerating that kind of behavior anymore. And, it might not be that these bullies were taught how to bully, but it was maybe adults turned a blind eye when it happened. And now there's just a more sort of general sense that we're not allowing that anymore. And so I do think, you know, what's going to happen on the street is what's happening nationwide. There's just this slow evolution where people are more accepting. They no longer care about choice. You know, it's the moral question is now sort of resolving itself. It's just kind of like, oh, okay, that's how you live your life.
And in terms of what's next, public education is certainly a pressing issue. There is still a law in Utah and in many states that prohibits teachers in public schools from even really mentioning homosexuality and sex education as if it doesn't exist. So same-sex marriage is now legal in the state of Utah, and it's not even clear that children can learn that fact legally. And so for years after interracial marriage was legal, southern states continued to teach children that it was bad for the gene pool and immoral.
To mix the races.
But
yeah.
They don't do that anymore.
And I think the interracial marriage example is a good one because that battle was won without anybody saying, oh, there are certain individuals who are born loving the other race and we have to allow them to not live lonely lives, right? Instead, the argument was individuals have a right to make this you know, incredibly personal decision without interference from the government. And it doesn't matter how you came to, you know, love another race or whether you could choose to love someone of the same race. That was never even made. It's an irrational sort of thing to think in the interracial marriage context. I think it should be the same sort of framework should apply to same-sex marriage. It doesn't matter how you came to love that same-sex person. Do you have a right to liberty or do you not? And that's the basis on which we should be winning these rights, not being born that way or not.
It's the perfect segue into the question of the legal matter now. You quote the New York Times columnist Frank Bruni in your article. He wrote this. He said, there are problems with some gay advocates' insistence that homosexuality be discussed and regarded as something ingrained at the first breath. By hinging a whole movement on a conclusion that hasn't been and perhaps won't be proved beyond all doubt, they hitch it to a moving target. And this is your point. It's that it doesn't work as a legal strategy. It's not accurate in the first place. But to talk a little bit about this part, because this is the really critical part, obviously, to your
There is this myth that the nature argument is somehow embedded in the Constitution and that you can't be treated equally under our Constitution unless you were born the way you are. And that's just – it's not in there. What the Constitution says is that every individual is entitled to life, liberty, and property, can't be deprived of those rights without due process of law, and that most importantly, they're entitled to the equal protection of the laws. And of course, there's a lot of litigation about what those things mean, but born that way is just not in the Constitution. The Supreme Court now, 40 years ago, mentioned this issue in a very offhand way in a single sentence and sometimes mentions it again and sometimes doesn't. And it's but it's never really been a requirement of the Constitution. It's certainly not in there.
They did refer to this immutability argument in the recent ruling, though, and you do point that out in your paper. Here's how Kennedy puts it in the ruling. Their immutable nature dictates that same-sex marriage is their only real path to this profound commitment.
Yes, this is a deeply confused sentence. I mean, what does it mean to say that a same-sex couple is immutable? I mean, with no disrespect to the couple, right? We all change every day. We live and die, and our relationships change. And so I think what he meant to say is that their sexual orientation is immutable. That is, it can't be changed. We also know that that may be true, and it may not be true. And there was in the Prop 8 case, there was a ridiculous series of questions trying to navigate the apparently awkward fact that one of the litigants was a woman who had been married to a man, then got divorced, and now wanted to marry a woman, as if this had anything to do with the case. But the lawyers were very nervous about it for all the reasons we discussed. And there was I never really loved him, she had to say, and now this is true love. It's like, this is totally irrelevant.
And, you know, I think – and that's an example of, you know, where someone like Cynthia Nixon was like, well, I was straight and now I'm gay. And I don't know exactly how, but here I am.
She this wonderful line. She said, it doesn't matter whether I swam here or I ran here. The point is that I'm here.
Right. you know, it's the other thing that you argue is that – and you go through sort of a number of different – alternatives to the immutability argument, and I wanted to go through a few of these. You argue this doesn't really need to be about sexual orientation, and this is a point actually argued by Chief Justice Roberts in this most recent case, that what he's saying in his oral argument was, I don't think you need the sexual orientation part. Isn't this a sexual discrimination case? Would you explain that?
Yeah, and that is to say sex discrimination. The simplest way to put this is a man walks into the county clerk's office and says, I'd like to get married. Clerk says, no. And says, why not? Because you're a man and you want to marry a man. If he had been a woman, he would get the marriage license. But because he's a man, he doesn't. That's sex discrimination. It's discrimination based on his sex and the sex of his partner. And it is already well settled that any discrimination based on sex is looked at very negatively by the Supreme Court, very suspiciously, and usually is struck down as unconstitutional.
It came up in the Prop 8 case.
Yes. It comes up again and again in these cases. It's been there from the very beginning. In 1993, when Hawaii was poised to legalize same-sex marriage, this is the argument that the Hawaii Supreme Court adopted.
The same thing for the argument that same-sex relationships were bad for children. That's turned around now.
A total 180. That is, for decades is a dramatic understatement here, even centuries. The primary justification for discriminating against gay people or people who engaged in homosexual conduct was that they were harming kids, either by abusing them or recruiting, indoctrinating, influencing, whatever, role modeling. But increasingly the recognition is, well, that's not true. The premise of all that is somehow that they're child predators. That's been completely debunked by the science, and that it presumes that if a kid were to grow up to be gay, that that would somehow be a problem. And then conversely, and the Supreme Court has now twice recognized this, when you deny two people who are raising a child, deny them the right to marry, you harm their children. You tell their children, this is not really your mother. This is not really your father. And this is not really a family that you have.
Yeah.
And
Kennedy was big on this one.
Absolutely.
About the humiliation of millions of
kind of
children.
Profound the way he wrote about that. It was interesting, it seems to me. This question of moral disapproval, you say, Clifford Roski, used to work in the favor of people opposed to same-sex marriage, but not anymore. That's also turned.
Absolutely. So the old argument was, oh, we're not picking on any groups. It's just that there are certain kinds of conduct, indeed, Justice Scalia himself said, murder, polygamy, incest. These are things that we don't want people to do. And homosexual conduct is one of the things we don't want people to do. It's immoral. And the Supreme Court has now recognized that, well, that's a clever, nice distinction, but there is a group of people that engages in this conduct and indeed in some sense is defined by the desire to engage in this conduct. So what you're really saying is that these people are immoral and that the Constitution does not permit. You cannot say of a group of people, you are immoral.
Finally, on this legal point, you say the court has increasingly found that this is a matter of choice. This has gone to this question of, I'm not sure if that's turned, but that seems to have turned as well. This is your – it doesn't matter if you swam here or ran here. You're here and you have that choice.
Indeed, that is the basis for the marriage decision. There were two ways to decide it. They could have said as a matter of law, gay people are equal to everyone else. Or they could have said every individual has the right, the freedom, the liberty to choose who they marry. They picked option number two. The whole decision is about – how marriage is a fundamental right that every American enjoys. Gay people are Americans just like everyone else. Same-sex couples, bisexuals, any individual has this freedom to marry. And the government could only deny that right for a very, very good reason, and they hadn't come up with one. So that's all about the choice. It's about this choice is none of the government's business. That's the principle that the Supreme Court
ruled upon.
It's
basically whether you flew here or swam here.
That's right.
You know, you can choose your partner however you came to make that choice.
You don't have to go into the county clerk's office and explain why you picked your
partner.
That's
none of their business. Right. The fact is you're here. So that's why you're making this point that the moment is now.
Yeah. I mean, I think for many years, the framework, the legal alternatives were not so clear. And maybe the born this way argument was all we really had going for us as a community. I think these recent court decisions, I would love it if it sort of put the nail in the coffin. Like now we've turned the corner in a really historic way. And given that the science is also in a state that it has never been before, where we now know more about the problems with the immutability argument. The combination of the sort of scientific moment and the legal moment makes now a really good time to really try and come together both from a scientific and legal perspective and say, you know what, that was where we were before. We're not there anymore.
Let's take another quick break and get some final thoughts when we get back. Lisa Diamond, professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah with us, along with Clifford Roski, law professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, and Jim Tabery, philosophy professor also at the university, joining us here. We'll take a break and get back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are, well, I've oversimplified it, but talking about that question, are you born gay or are you born bisexual or straight? It's been a crucial question in the debate over same-sex marriage and equal rights for LGBT people, but the professors Clifford Roski and Lisa Diamond are saying it's time to get rid of that debate, and we've been talking about it throughout the hour. We also have Jim Tabery, a philosophy professor at the University of Utah. Let's go back to the phones. Skylar is with us in Salt Lake City. Skylar, not a lot of time, but welcome.
Hi. Yeah, we've been told for a long time that you are born gay, people are born gay, and heterosexuals don't choose to be gay, gay people don't choose to be gay. And I personally bought into that, and I perpetuated that to many people, even within my own religious community, people that have been termed as bigots for thinking that it was a choice. And so now I'm just wondering, do we owe an apology to people that said that there is choice involved with choosing to be gay? Or where do we stand there? Do we owe an apology to those people, or is it just...
Well, Lisa Diamond, do you owe an apology to religious people who say, hey, we were right, you weren't born that way?
I don't know about the issue of apology. I think we also... the main people that I feel like everyone deserves an apology are individuals who felt that their own sexuality was inauthentic because their own experience didn't fit that very early developing narrative. So I think the motives of certain religious communities to call it a choice are sometimes dubious, because if they're saying, well, it's a choice and it's an immoral choice, and you're choosing to just act out and, you know, do bad things, I don't necessarily feel a need to apologize to individuals who use the choice argument as a bludgeon against LGBT individuals. But I do think that we do need to develop a more nuanced way to talk about sexuality, both among religious communities and not among religious communities. And I think that strategy of finding a way that is inclusive to everyone is going to benefit everyone. There are individuals who do experience their sexuality as very early developing and stable. I'm not saying that those individuals don't exist.
Yeah.
I'm saying that the
because we are hearing from some people who are saying, look, you're freaking me out. I'm gay.
And
I was born this way.
And
what are you saying?
They probably have.
Yeah.
Were like this.
Yeah.
So there are different collections of individuals. There are some individuals who basically, I think if you stuck them in any country, in any part of the world, they would have ended up gay. And there are folks whose trajectories are more variable. All of them deserve the same legal protections.
Which gets us to the sort of the final point in your argument, Clifford Roski and Lisa Diamond, that it's unjust, that what you're doing when you define a sexual orientation as something fixed is you leave out a whole range of people. Clifford Roski, will you talk about that part?
Yeah, and there's two ways of thinking about the unfairness. The way I tend to think about it, which we've discussed a bit, is when someone asks, are you born that way? How did you become gay? The clear implication for many years is that there's something wrong with it, that if you could change, then you should change, right? And we would never say that, even though many people believe you're born with your race, for example, or you're born with – race is a good example.
Yeah.
So suppose that a technology were developed, a pill that makes you white and has no side effects whatsoever. Would it be okay now that you don't have to stay a person of color to say you can have a job if you take the white pill? You can become president of the United States if you take the white pill. Obviously, this is would be an immoral requirement. It would be an unconstitutional requirement. It's racist. And it doesn't matter how easy it is to change your race, that the question's irrelevant. And so that's the way in which it's the injustice is the implication that there's something wrong with homosexuality. That's one way of saying it.
Yeah, and then the other is just that there are so many people whose experiences are more variable that if you develop a legal strategy that basically invalidates their experience or says they're not worthy, that's just fundamentally wrong as well.
Jim Tabery, let me ask you, One thing you've talked about is this this divide and how we come to a kind of resolution between this ongoing debate about nature versus nurture. And one of the things you've written about is finding a bridge. Would you say something about that finally? Because I think it helps us get sort of get to the point that I think the professors are trying to get to, and that is how do we move on from these old arguments?
Yeah, I mean, this is the latest instantiation of conversations that humans have been having about themselves for millennia. I mean, in a real sense, what we're talking about here is about human nature. We're asking questions about what makes us similar as humans and different from the rest of the world, and what makes us different. Why are you different from me? Why is your neighbor different from you? You can go all the way back to Plato and Aristotle are wrestling with these kinds of questions. What makes the current science of genetics and, say, Professor Diamond's social psychology interesting now is it looks like this is how science weighs in on these questions of similarity and difference. It looks like it's now telling us something about what human nature, about why we are the way we are and what makes us different from each other. But to go back to the conversation you were having with Professor Diamond earlier, if there's one consensus, it's that whether we're talking about sexuality, schizophrenia, intelligence, it's both. There are no genes for any of those things, but there are certainly genetic contributions to all of them. There are no single environmental factors that differentiate us from each other, but you can bet there's environmental contributions to all of them. And what makes it sort of frustrating is the consensus is everybody knows it's both. And then beyond that, we don't have a lot more to say. And, you know, it's like, okay, it's both. And, you know,
and we're going to have to be fine with that.
And you're going to have to live with that. That's right. Yeah. And separate that from the moral question, you know, about whether or not that thing you're evaluating is the kind of thing you're judging with some sort of value framework.
Man, that would be hard. The moral question, certainly around here, and based on some of the comments we're getting, it's hard to tease that out, is it not, Clifford Ruskin?
It is. And even that question about do we owe an apology is sort of rich in its moral complexity, right? I mean, precisely because people who targeted LGBT people were saying it's a choice, it's the wrong choice for so many years, it's perfectly understandable that the movement responded by saying it's not a choice, we're born that way, relied on every scientific fact that could possibly support that, and there were some tantalizing findings in the early 90s. But then, you know, I don't think you owe an apology for repeating the things that you've heard from good authorities, right, if you did it with honesty, but maybe it's time for a change.
And again, there are some individuals whose sexuality is more sort of fixed and determined. The point is that the total group of individuals who's advocating for legal rights and protections includes a mix of individuals with a very early developing trajectory and then folks who are different. And the entire community deserves legal status and respect.
Lisa Diamond, professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah. Clifford Roski, law professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law. Jim Tabery, philosophy professor at the university. Thank you all very much for being
with us. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.